Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Media and Communications. I'm Monica Wookie, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to James Poyner about his new book, Trump Tweets, His Social Media Phenomena. James Poyner, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Monica.
Now, I understand, James, that this is your first book.
Yes, it is. I figured might as well do something interesting for my first one. I'll make it too easy for myself.
Well, you certainly did that. So congratulations on that. It is an interesting book. We'll get into more depth in a second with that. James, I'd just like you to start off with giving a little bit of a bio about yourself.
Sure. I was born in the UK, in Northern Ireland, and I have a degree in creative writing, but an engineering in engineering. So I've been involved in global media for most of my working adult life, mainly in the background in broadcasting, which means I've had the opportunities to not only work at home in my original home in the UK, but in the Middle East for Al Jazeera, and also now in Melbourne. And through that freelance work, I've been able to do some live broadcasting work for during the Summer and Winter Olympic Games in the last 6 years. So just gives me this sense of global perception of the world and how people in important positions in sort of politics and the media are perceived by the different sort of media groups around the world. These days, as well as writing books, I also co-edit our local paper, The Warrandyte Diary, with my partner, and that keeps us pretty busy. So I'm pretty much a jobbing journalist these days, and with a bit of book writing on the side.
Bit of jack of all trades.
That was the idea.
Fantastic. So first of all, why Trump tweets? What drew you to the subject matter?
Well, so Wilkinson Publishing, I know that it's a small publisher in Melbourne, and I met the guy who runs the company about 6 months prior to this book, over the idea of doing a different project, which fell through. It was just a coincidence. New Year's Eve, just gone. I get an email from him saying, we're thinking about doing this book about Trump and how he tweets and, you know, something like 100 funniest tweets and stuff like that. So I said, okay, I'll have a think about it. And being sort of driven by literature and literary ideas and sort of the how words are used to convey ideas, and having when I was a teenager, I had a tiny bit of a man crush on Hunter S. Thompson for a while and all this stuff, and I kind of figured, we could do Trump's 100 funniest tweets, and that's a bit boring, and yeah, we could whack out in 3 weeks, but it's a bit boring. So why not do something a bit more Thompson-esque and look at, you know, Trump on the campaign trail? And I thought, well, how am I qualified for this? Well, I'm not really qualified for this, but, you know, sort of I'm not a political journalist, but I am aware of social media, and I'm aware of how communication is perceived by people and how media thinks that people perceive media. So I just pitched this idea. I thought, why don't we just track his campaign through social media and see if the policies that he's pushing are indeed what he thinks. And 3 weeks later, we had the first draft of a book. And that was it, really. It was just this interesting idea. And I thought, you know, why not? I mean, Trump is the president of the United States, and the US is a global player. Everybody in even the smallest way is affected by US policy, especially foreign policy. So, you know, who's the best person to write that sort of book? Well, without sounding egotistical, a person who has global experience, a person who has experienced the world, especially through media, is maybe able to bring this sense of objectivity to what he does, and to look at it not from a political alignment point of view, but just from how he's perceived globally. And that was about it, really. It was just this crazy idea, and you know, I figured, well, you know, why not? Let's give it a go. What's the worst that can happen? And I mean, I guess the only thing is, when I was writing the book, I didn't the idea that he was going to become the president of the United States. I was aware of that idea, but it hadn't really entirely sunk in. I think if it had been a month later and they'd said, "Oh, we want you to write a book about Donald Trump's tweeting habits," and he was already the president, I think I may have said no, because it's the only way I can compare it to. It's a bit like saying, "Oh, you know, because I'm English," it'd be like saying, "Oh, you know, we want you to write a book about the Queen and how she uses Facebook." You know, I would sort of, I don't think I'd go near that, because that's terrifying. And, you know, and the idea of the book is terrifying. Just because of who he is. But at the time, I was sort of caught up in this romance of being this political writer and this commentator, and, you know, being able to practice this idea of being, you know, the doctor of words, you know, Thompson-esque. And I did it.
Fantastic. It sounds like it was a very organic process, and I got that feeling as I was reading the book. So let's jump straight into it now. You break the book up into very specific milestones: Trump versus ISIS, Trump versus Obamacare, etc.
Sure.
I think this is naturally how a lot of people perceive Trump, as he's fighting the world, he's fighting his enemies. But you start with Trump versus the Republicans. Why Trump against his own party?
Well, we know a little bit more now. So we know that this the relationship that he has was not it was maybe more manufactured than it was perceived at the time. And I guess the thing to remember is that when I was writing this, he'd won the vote. He was going to become the Republican runner, but it wasn't guaranteed that he was going to become president. So there's a lot of stuff we know now, which we didn't know then. But to get back to the question, he's this rogue element. He's this outsider. He has no political experience compared to everybody, all of the other 16 other candidates who are running. And they saw him as dangerous because he has these crazy wild ideas. And because he knows how to work people, there was this serious concern, I believe, within the Republican Party that he was going to derail the entire Republican Party by being the man who represents them. So you look at all of the debates and the people who you'd normally say were gonna be the contenders. So yeah, you've got their names have left me now. That's really irritating.
Such a long time ago now.
The names of whoever they were, sorry, that's terrible. Whoever they were, the key players, they were who you think were going to run against Hillary. Whereas he's scary. He's you know, without, in many ways, he's a bit of a dictator. You know, he approached the American election like it was a business strategy. And that was it. He saw the presidency as a job, as a business opportunity. And that's how he progressed. And that isn't conventional politics. And the fear is, I think the fear was that he was not only going to derail the Republican Party, but he's going to upset the way that people perceive how politics works in the US. And they didn't want that. You know, they need a candidate they can control. The Republican Party needs someone on side, and Trump wasn't on side, and he probably still isn't on side. He's Trump, you know. He's not blah 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 Republican Party. He's just Donald Trump. So they if you analyze what he says and what they say, both in the debates and on Facebook and Twitter and in the media, you had this trend where they were trying their damnedest to stop him, but they were restricted to within the confines of political norms, which is never going to work with this person. So that's why I decided to open with that, because I wanted to illustrate that he was this rogue candidate. But also because we needed a way to get into the book, and it made sense to start with his battle to become the nominated Republican Party representative.
You've mentioned the debates a couple of times then.
Mm.
It was fantastic for a lot of people to watch the debates comparing his rhetoric to the other candidates. You did mm-hmm. note, however, that in the final Republican debate, his rhetoric calmed, he was a bit more embracing, he received a lot of support on Twitter afterwards, and his detractors were much more subdued than usual. What yes. changed?
I think he... So this is an interesting shift that we sort of noticed post the timeline of the book. You see this as well, which is, so it's worth mentioning now. It's a business strategy. So he has this aggressive, hostile takeover approach to business, where he has to you know, annihilate the opposition, and he has similar ideas when he's talking about military strategy, you know, about annihilating the enemy, about, you know, sort of shock and awe and all that stuff. And so he gets to the point where he's won essentially, and now his job is to unite the country. So I think he just changed gears. He went from Trump the aggressor to Trump the politician in a scary sense. And he had to start doing the job. So, and you can't, as much as it's very entertaining to watch Trump berate everybody who disagrees with him, but I think even he realized that that's not a successful strategy to uniting a country behind him. And I think if he'd continued his aggressive approach, that the subsequent process, which happened after he was inaugurated, would have been on a much grander scale, and we'd have been looking at a situation where he would have been removed from office due to, you know, widespread public protests. But I think it was always his plan. He always planned to be aggressive to his competitors and then to be nice to the people to get them behind him. And I think that's why he did it. And it was nice in a way, because it showed that he was capable of acting diplomatic and political, even if it's only a tiny sliver of those qualities, that he does possess them.
You've mentioned the shock and awe tactics and how he likes mm-hmm. to go after everyone. I think no one since kindergarten has used so many nicknames than Trump. You noted that the phrase Crooked Hillary appeared 72 times in July alone.
Yes.
What effect do nicknames like this have?
Well, this is also about his embracing of social media. He's all about catchphrases and memorable sort of phrases and quotes and all this stuff. And this is how people use social media. And I think it had a big effect. You know, if somebody in a significant position in society labels someone else in a certain way for good or bad things, it's people, the people that make up that society they take that on board. And, you know, and it's all about communicating an idea simply. So he could have gone through a long-winded diatribe about why Hillary Clinton was corrupt, and then people wouldn't listen to it. But by just you know, crooked Hillary or any of the other phrases he used through his entire campaign. I mean, there's, you know, we'll talk about that later. There's an entire chapter on his hashtag policy, which is a major drive, which falls under the same idea. It's all about giving people who aren't necessarily engaged in the political process an idea that they can latch onto. In many ways, he's trying to speak the mind of the common person, you know, the voters that will come out in droves and will get him into power are the people that he is trying to connect with. And you know, everybody can relate to a catchphrase. It's easy to remember. You don't need a hell of a lot of background information. You have one phrase and you can roughly link it to an idea, and then that's all you need. And then people feel that they're included in a process because they can use this catchphrase effectively, and they can say it and people will know what they're talking about.
So would you say these catchphrases and nicknames are not only a rhetorical device that Trump uses to reinforce a certain message, but in a way it's also a natural byproduct of the medium that he's using?
Yes, I think that's accurate. Yes, it's all to do with the technology, like say Twitter, for example, where we're limited to a certain number of characters, 142 characters. And I know that it's developed now that that's no longer a thing, because people, as Trump does, you know, you do these entire essays on Twitter and they're just all linked together. But the basic idea is something short and succinct. And I think that to deviate slightly, there, I read an interesting study the other day which said the latest generation using social media now have a shorter attention span than goldfish, and goldfish has an attention span of 12 seconds, and the average attention span of a teenager is about 7. So as a society, who have been trained to use these amazing tools to communicate globally or even locally with strangers and our peers, that our attention spans have dropped, and people are looking for essentially linguistic shorthand to allow them to communicate ideas. I think his use of catchphrases and hashtagging is a byproduct of the age of social media we live in, but it's also key to communicating with people because our attention spans have become a byproduct of the age of social media and digital communication. So it's the only way to be successful. I talk about the end of the book. There's this some of the most successful candidates in American political history have been the ones who have found a way to not only embrace but harness new forms of communication to their advantage. And Trump is just the next rung on the ladder. He's okay. Obama did use Twitter and Facebook, and Obama linked the White House page to Facebook, and he did lots of amazing things. But Trump was the first one to where his primary campaign policy took place in the digital space.
You made the reference there before to the end of the book, where you talk about how successful presidential communicators harness new technologies. Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, you compare Hillary's and Trump's tweets. For example, when discussing the response to ISIS, you show when Trump tweets, he has two ones in particular that stood out to me. He said, only I can defeat ISIS, and Obama is the founder of ISIS.
Yes.
To which Hillary simply responds, no, Obama is not the founder of ISIS.
So yes.
Do you think that Hillary perhaps lagged behind in this uptake of new technology? Because obviously she was using it, but as you can see there, the rhetoric is worlds apart.
Yeah, no, totally. This is, I mean, I think this is why eventually, you know, he won, because the only, in my opinion, the only way that if anybody other than Donald Trump was running as the Republican candidate, then it was Hillary Clinton's election. She was going to get it. You know, the American government system has made amazing leaps and bounds since they elected Barack Obama, and you know, they were going to go from the first black president in American history to having the first woman president in American history, which would have been an amazing evolutionary step forward in politics in the US, and would have probably done amazing things for you know, equality and human rights as well. But that was what the politicians wanted. That's what the people in politics and the percentage of Americans which were actively engaged in politics, this is what they wanted. Whereas what they were competing against were the out of work shale oil workers and the conventional industries which were being systematically disassembled for global warming, for economics, for all sorts of reasons, and that was the battleground. And yes, and although Hillary and Barack Obama were using social media, they didn't have the history. He's the joy of writing this book was to be able to go back and look at Trump's history on Twitter, and he's used it and all the time, and he's so comfortable with it now that he just says what he wants, and so yeah, that's, you know, they were never going to compete with him on that front. I don't think anybody in that election was able to use Twitter as effectively as Donald Trump, because he's been doing it for so long. You know, he just uses it naturally. Well, the perception is that he's it's almost become an extension of himself. In fact, I'm still convinced that it is an extension of himself. You know, there's this great I noticed it must have been about 6 weeks after 6 weeks after the book, the timeline of the book finishes, and he starts sort of, he's gearing up his social media action again, and he starts to well, at first he's sort of moderating himself, so his POTUS Twitter account is a lot more balanced than at Donald Trump, but then at some point POTUS starts retweeting what Donald Trump is saying, which, I mean, the ego of the man, I mean, they're essentially the same person, and often now you see there's a bit of a blur, and sometimes you can't tell if he's being POTUS or if he's being Donald, but you know, there's only someone who's that comfortable with a social media platform, only that person can you know, imagine that it's okay to retweet yourself on a different account. You know, it's just there's no one, only he could have done what he did The others, they had the political backing and the force and the experience in politics, but that's not where politics is going. You know, we'll talk about it later. There's this trend in global politics where conventional way of doing things, especially in Western politics, is no longer, people don't buy it anymore. People are leaning more towards the extreme ends of parties for recognition and connection with someone in power. And Trump was just a catalyst in to show that those sorts of people are able to actually get into positions where they can do some, I'm going to be careful how I say this, some who can actually make a difference to the world, good or bad.
You said earlier then that one of your favorite parts of writing this book was being able to go back through some of Trump's old tweets. I noticed that you managed to dig up a tweet from 2009 that actually referenced building the wall. And there were several other tweets long before the campaign began where he was mentioning a wall. When did the wall become mainstream?
I think from Trump's point of view
when did the media pick up on it?
Only when it became a policy of his. You know, he's been talking about it for a long time. But yeah, it wasn't until it became an actual campaign policy that the media began to sit up and pay attention to what he was actually saying. And I mean, you see this through a lot of his policies, like his anti Obamacare stance. He's been fairly consistent on that for a long time, but nobody paid any attention when he was just this real estate mogul. You know, when he was just businessman and occasional celebrity, people didn't really care what he said. But it was only when he got into a situation where he could actually influence the outcome of the nation that the media began to pay more attention to what he was actually saying. Which, you know, maybe more for them. I don't know. Well, I mean, we'll see how all that goes. But yeah, you know, I think if people paid attention to what he was saying a lot sooner, then the last election would have gone slightly differently, because the world, the media at least, and maybe even his political rivals would have been a little more prepared for what he was going to do.
It's been well documented how Trump has attacked his enemies. He calls people fake news. For example, when the Russian hacking accusations persisted, he called anyone who was making those accusations sleazeball political operatives. Mm-hmm. However, an interesting aspect that I think you picked up on was how Trump also supports and embraces his allies. For example, in 2015, after there was a storm over Trump's comments about Muslims, the British journalist Katie Hopkins wrote a piece defending Trump, to which Trump tweeted, "Thank you to respected columnist Katie Hopkins of DailyMail.com for her powerful writing in the UK's Muslim problems." What do you make of this embracement of quote-unquote allies?
It's all about, it's just good PR in many ways. I mean, I guess the cornerstone to a lot of what he says, it's as I said before, the presidency, he ran his campaign like it was a business. But I think what's probably more accurate, especially on this subject, is that there are stages where he looks at the position of president of the United States of America as a product, and maybe him in that role also as a product. And you know, what's the best way to get people to embrace an idea is to get everybody talking about it. You know, good or bad, it doesn't matter. You know, if he's consciously recognizing, I mean, we said it in the book that he, Katie Hopkins isn't the most liked person in the world. You know, she's hated. She's a columnist for the Daily Mail, and people hate her. And what I've discovered is that if people like people in media, they tend not to vocalize their approval and how much they like a journalist or a paper or something. But if people don't like a journalist or a newspaper or something, they're very vocal about it. So all, as well as him sort of this ally being a way of him being able to push his anti-Muslim policy, which was a way of him engaging with I guess lower income white middle America who do feel threatened by this IS, and the clumsy way that it's connected with Islam, and that people often perceive that they're both the same thing, when they're not. I mean, they're worlds apart. I mean, I say this from experience. I lived in a Muslim country for a year, and I've seen, yes, there's a lot of repression in societies which are driven by Islam, but then if we lived in a society which was a country where Christianity was the cornerstone of government policy, we'd probably have similar perceptions of that sort of society. So it's you know, religion and politics never quite mix very well, and I guess the rise of IS and the way that right wing politics has taken an aggressive approach to IS by linking it with a Muslim problem is all part of a strategy of almost a strategy of fear to get people to fall in line, because then you say if you don't agree with what I'm saying, then you're essentially letting IS in. But again, to get back to what you're saying, it's just good PR. If people are talking about how Trump and Katie are essentially media bedfellows, and that it's disgusting what they're doing and all this stuff, or even if they're saying they like it, it doesn't matter. The fact is that people are engaged with what Trump is saying and his policy, which means people are aware of it, and that just filters down. And I think at the end of the day, when it comes to voting, I think often that people vote for what they can relate to. And if everybody's been talking about Donald Trump for 6 months, then people just remember everything that he says. And through that, people then feel that they can relate to him. So it's just this domino effect of media. You know, he could say whatever he wants. I mean, if he'd chosen to side with somebody who was pro-Islam, we would be having the same conversation. I mean, we'd be having the conversation because it'd be weird, because he'd be, oh yes, this person is right. There isn't a Muslim problem, but I want to keep them out. But it would still be the same thing. He just needs a vehicle, and Katie Hopkins was a wonderfully volatile vehicle for him to cuddle up to.
You mentioned then how the communication filters down. So from terms of whether you loved him or hated him, it seemed people couldn't avoid talking or tweeting about Trump. You mm-hmm. highlighted some anti-Trump movements on Twitter, for example, hashtag Trump Noir, hashtag mm-hmm. things Trump thinks are overrated, hashtag Golden Showergate. Do mm-hmm. you think that this is part of the old maxim that there's no such thing as bad publicity? Do you think this would have overly concerned Trump, or it was just par of the course?
I think it's all part of the course. I mean, you know, he didn't even the interesting thing about the anti-Trump hashtag trends on Twitter is that he didn't, although that his actions instigated the creation of these ideas. That was it. There were all people. These saw that these happened organically within the Twitterverse. You know, Twitter rose up and said no, and this is how we're going to make fun of him. And yeah, it's definitely part of the course. It's all PR. I mean, you know, yes, they're all saying that they're making fun of him. But it doesn't matter. It means that even the people who disagree with his policies are constantly thinking about Donald Trump, which means that they can be swayed. You know, who's to say that somebody who commented on the things Trump thinks are overrated hashtag didn't then at some point turn around and go, oh, actually, you know, I've been ranting about how he says these things are terrible for so long, but maybe he's got a point. You know, it's just. It's all, if you're thinking about him, then you are being influenced by him for good or bad. You know, the best thing I think that people could have done would be to, if they'd all ignored him, if they just let him tweet all he wants and not done anything about it, I think he wouldn't have had so much power online. They were inadvertently they become integral parts of his social media campaign machine.
Well, certainly mainstream media did not ignore the Donald. You noted that there's obviously a frosty relationship between Trump and CNN now. However, mm-hmm. you also pointed out that it wasn't always this way. When mm-hmm. did it turn and why?
It seems to be whenever they say, you see this across a lot of media. As soon as a recognized media body disagreed with anything that he said, or accused him of misquoting or fudging statistics or exaggerating or anything, he took an aggressive anti-media approach to them. And I think, and I can't remember exactly where it happens, but it's just, if CNN had then turned coat and had been, Donald Trump is amazing, fantastic, then he would have probably changed his mind and he would have embraced them happily. But I think their decision to report on, the Golden Shower Gate incident, the document. I think that was the nail in the coffin with regards to Trump and CNN, you know, sort of the, because I guess the fear is that at that point it's still, and probably still is now, it's still just scandal. It's just this wonderfully Tom Clancy-esque idea of, you know, political thrillers and governments secretly moving in the background to influence other governments, you know, the I mean, I said in a book, it read exactly like a political thriller, you know. And I think because what they saw is they saw an opportunity to, because at this point, sort of media had almost become a casualty of its own sensationalism. You know, they were the press were aware that Trump was generating this massive amount of media content on his own, and they were just looking for ways of showing, I guess, the American populace that they were still there. And so they jumped on this golden shower thing and they reported on it. And, you know, and they, as far as Trump was concerned, they went too far. And I think they did, because everybody else pretty much stayed away from it because they saw it as dangerous territory. And yeah, I mean, the only news organization which has ever, it seems, has ever gotten into Trump's bad books and has then made a miraculous sort of return to good form in his eyes is the Fox News network. And unfortunately, it's not unfortunate because it's true, but the Fox News network is, you know, very, very, very right. And they don't hide it at all. They are almost in many ways the megaphone for the Republican Party at times. And so they were always going to come good again. You know, I think almost in a way you could even view that maybe his pop at Fox News and their remarkable return to form was a way of him sticking it in the face to the other media organizations to say, look, you know, I'm not alienating you out of spite. You know, I'm doing it because you said something I don't like. But his choice of who he chose to show that he could be reasonable, I guess, was bad, because, you know, because nobody takes Fox News seriously.
Do you think his relationship with the media almost got stuck in a cycle? Because, like you said, he would turn on an organization after they said something negative, and then Trump would say, look, they're after me. And then his supporters would say, yeah, the mainstream media are out to get you. They're after you. And then he'd be like, see, my supporters say that you're after me. Do you think it sort of got stuck in that cycle?
Yeah, this is what I was trying to get at when I was talking about a victim of their own sensationalization. Yeah, I mean, and all that does is then drive these alienated organizations to try and to try and prove him wrong by reporting more on it. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of games being played during the election by everybody, you know. And I mean, there's this that I remember watching Barack Obama's last press conference to the media corps in the White House, and like the first 20 minutes of his talk is about how the media need to remain accountable, need to keep the government accountable, and that he embraced having them in the White House, and he although he often disagrees with what they say, he understands that the nature of their society is that the media should be disagreeing with the government often, because that's their job. Their job is to challenge what people of influence are saying, and that was very, very obvious that he was thanking the media for what they'd done, but he was also, it was almost his last, you know, his final blow in the ring for the presidency, was for him to highlight that this media war had been going on. So yeah, it got really out of hand. I mean, it was just, if this had been any other election, it wouldn't have gone nearly as far as it did. But they were all there, you know, they were feeding each other. And like we were saying earlier about good PR, you know, anything, any sort of conflict between the free press and the, you know, the president-elect, is good PR. Because again, people are talking about him. And yeah, it's, I mean, how many elections around the world does the world like stop and watch to see what happens? You know, I mean, there's elections in the UK coming up, and you know, we don't have round the clock coverage of the campaigning going on there. Only, you know, every 4 years the US election comes up and the world stops and we watch to see what's going to happen. You know, so they know that they have this massive media presence and that people watch what they say. And I think I think it's a bit like a drug. They all became intoxicated by how much people were paying attention, not only to the politicians, but to the media as well. And it all become polarized to extremes, which is, so yeah, so it just fed itself. It was, you know, it was like the snake, you know, the infinity symbol. It just kept going round and round and round and round and round.
I can't remember the exact figures at this point, but I remember someone did a study relatively early on, and they calculated how much free press Trump received just from people talking about him and what that would have cost him in ad space to get that. And it was something like it ran into the billions just because so many people were talking about him, but he got all that for free. So I think that feeds into the, what you're talking about how the snake eating itself and how they fed off each other and the sensationalism of it all, and the spectacle, because they know it's a spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, to use an internet term, essentially he went viral for the election, you know, and yeah, that's worth financially, like putting dollar signs on publicity. That's just phenomenal, you know. So yeah, he worked it really well. You know, he did a really good PR job on everybody.
You've mentioned media sensationalism a couple of times, and you had a really good quote that I wanted to point out when you were discussing the infamous Access Hollywood tapes and the subsequent media response. You said, in terms of media sensationalism and public reaction, the tweets and live Facebook press conference can be viewed analytically in a similar vein to Golden Shower Gate. So although there was a dip in the polls after that tape was released, do you think because it sort of fed into this sensationalism and what Trump supporters saw as mainstream media going after him, that's why he was able to recover?
Yes, completely. There is more. It did. I guess the other thing is that I found myself often when I was researching this, I found myself sort of sitting there and thinking, you know, only Donald Trump could be caught saying these things, and only Donald Trump can find a way to spin it so that he comes out good. So yeah, I think, and again, the media are victims of their own sensationalism. They should have, people already knew that he had he has interesting views about women, which are really not appropriate for modern society, and are definitely not appropriate for someone in his position. But so they should have just left it alone, but they didn't, because it gets people tuning into their network to see what they're talking about. And yeah, it's totally the same thing. You know, something which should have been like a mortal blow to anybody's political campaign did very little damage, and was more damaging to the press that reported on it than the person that they were targeting. Those were two really good examples. I'm pretty sure there was more through the election, which I just hadn't seen. In fact, no, there was. There was but there was a really early rally where the fire marshal didn't allow his hundreds of thousands of supporters into the venue or something, and it was spun as how this fire marshal was a lefty and was trying to sabotage Trump's campaign, and it turns out that's complete false. That it was just they'd agreed the venue could hold a certain number of people, and they hit that number, and there were still more people outside, and his job was to not let them in. But the media jumped on it because he jumped on it, and again it just fed the snake. So I guess the scary thing is that these are probably the new concepts which will drive future elections in at least Western societies around the world, that people will use this level of theater and in a way manipulation of the media to get their message across, to engage with people who can make a difference but don't normally vote.
You said a couple of times a phrase that I think a lot of other commentators have picked up on, and that's only Trump could get away with this, or some version of only Trump could do this. You pointed out that after the infamous Access Hollywood tapes and there was a dip in the polls, mainstream Republicans started distancing themselves from Trump. So then Trump proceeds to go on a tirade, and he just does tweet after tweet after tweet against his own party, the party that if he's elected, he's supposed to lead. I think that was, well, what would you make of that? What would be your,
he'd become, because he had this history of rebellion within the party, that he'd come through it, you know, and he'd won that, you know. And so I think he thought he was invincible. And I think he knows that he can, that the ideas that he's pushing at that point about draining the swamp and all of this stuff about reforms in Washington to make the political process more honest, that he can use this mutiny as a weapon to prove. And I guess the thing is that at this point, you know, he's already threatened to run as an independent. You know, the first debate, when he said if he doesn't win the Republican vote, he can't guarantee that he won't pledge his support to the person who wins the vote. He's running for it regardless of who he runs for. He doesn't care. So if the Republican Party out him and replace him with, who knows, maybe Cruz or someone like that, then it's just ammunition for him. So he had nothing to lose when he said those things. which I think is why he said it, because he was so sure of his position, and he was so sure that they would fall in line. And then he'd know, I guess, in a way that he sort of owns them, because you know, nobody can compare to Trump, I guess, as far as Trump's ego perceives. So I think a lot of those tweets were just hot air and flack, to be honest. I think he was angry and he was saying those things, but I don't think there was any, in hindsight, there was no risk that he was going to be dethroned. But he still, to continue this trend in the way he expresses emotion and ideas on Twitter, he sort of had to say those things, which I guess brings up the idea of that has he become then a victim of his own machine? Is he now forced to say things that he has to say because historically he's taken that line? It's an interesting idea. I think I might have to explore that in my own time. But yeah, he's, you know, that's, I think, yeah, that's it. I think he's also in a way become a victim of his own success.
You mentioned in there the sort of rebellious outside of mentality of Trump. If there was one thing that Trump loved more than nicknaming his opponents, it was a good hashtag. You highlighted the drain the swamp phrase that was actually originally coined by politician and socialist Winfield R. Gaylord.
Mm-hmm.
How did a socialist phrase become the catch cry of a Republican?
Yeah, that was why I wanted to pursue it, really, because it was an interesting evolution. It's just been, from what I could tell, it's just been the idea, despite its origins, the idea has been used throughout U.S. political history as a metaphor for reform and change. And I think that it's used post 9/11 as a metaphor to signify that the US are going to clean up and reform Afghanistan and that whole region of the world in response to the September attacks. So I think there's this history of this phrase being used, and maybe not necessarily it's a phrase that the average voter will be aware of, but I think it rang true for a lot of people working in government. So I think that was more, as well as it being a catchy phrase and a nice metaphor for illustrating how Trump perceives the U.S. government to be this sort of a dirty cesspool of people just helping each other out without any real ambitions of doing government for the people. I think it was more a case of him using a well-known concept to illustrate to people in government that he meant business and that as a rogue candidate this was something that he could do because he's outside the system, and only someone outside the system can truly bring reform in, because they're not then influenced by the thing that they're trying to change.
In addition to using past metaphors, he was also quite partial to making his own. Possibly the most famous hashtag of all was MAGA, shortened hand for Make America Great Again. You describe the phrase as more powerful and aggressive than Hillary's I'm with her, etc., other phrases that became popular on her side. What do you think gave it that aggression? And do you think it goes back to the earlier point we were discussing about the use of new communicative tools and the difference between Hillary and Trump in that sense?
Yes, it's a bit of both. There is this idea about short phrases that people can relate to, and a 5-character hashtag is a lot easier if someone wants to communicate an idea within the confines of the MAGA hashtag, then they're able to more effectively, because they've still got 137 characters to play with. But I think also he had to shorten it for the purposes of social media. But I think that the power lies, unfortunately, whenever I heard Make America Great Again, all I could think of was Team America World Police. It was the only thing that goes through my head every time I hear it. But I it's relevant because there's this, at least I think there is this perception about, America as it's, I guess it's been a through history from the way that they intervened during two world wars and their entire history of how they're like the world's big brother, not in the Orwellian sense, but in terms of family, that they're there to have your back and to go in and to punch the bully in the face. Part of his strategy, part of his crooked Hillary strategy and all this stuff, was this idea that through diplomacy, on a global scale, to bring true global progress, the cornerstone of Obama's term, that somehow that's weakened the US, and this drives a lot of his policies, the whole build the wall policy, his anti-Muslim policy, it's all even the anti-Obamacare. There's this great quote where he says the greatest form of social welfare is employment. His answer to everything is just give everybody a job and they're happy and they're fine because they have money. And this is what he's driving. He's tuned into this romantic nostalgia of like post-war America where it was all American made and sleek new technology and all that artwork, all that modernist artwork from the US or postmodern artwork from the US, the sleek, the bullet trains and sort of that very futuristic sort of feel of a modern city. And I think in my opinion, a lot of his voters were trying to connect with that idea because they saw that as prosperous times. While the rest of the world was rebuilding from devastating war, the US had physical casualties, but largely their infrastructure was intact. So they didn't have to rebuild their society's structure. They just had to get on with it, which is where they became this strong powerhouse. And this is what Make America Great Again connects to. It's a very old-fashioned idea. But that's often how his voters were thinking, I think. They had old-fashioned ideas about what was amazing. And his part of his product PR, his advertising strategy for the job is to tell people what they want to hear, and that's what they wanted to hear.
You briefly touched on then Trump's point of view on a number of policies, healthcare, immigration, jobs, etc. A lot of the criticism from my point of view that I've noted of Trump is that people think he's rather inconsistent when it comes to policies. For mine, a very interesting thread that I found throughout your book was that you basically made the point of, if you were paying attention, there's a common thread that runs through all these policies, and he's had them for quite some time.
Yes. It's just the thread is just business. Everything he does is geared towards, I guess the best way to catch that is whenever I try to distill this down to a simple term, it's like I imagine Donald Trump standing in front of the concept and saying, how can I make money doing this? And that's what it's, I mean, his whole, like, part of his argument for, like, his big beef with China, he doesn't like China because, and he even said it, when he was being interviewed, I don't know, it wasn't an interview, it was his speech to announce that he was going to run to become president. He said that he sees China as a competitor. It's finance, you know. He sees IS as a financial competitor in many ways, both ideologically and he also. Now, I'd like to think it's metaphorical, but I don't think it was. He talked about how IS are able to build hotels in countries where he can't build them, you know, and just everything he does is how can I make money? And I think some of the attraction to him as president and some of the driving force behind his policies is that he's promised in different ways that he can translate this success that he's had at making money into politics which will allow everybody to have the same success, that he can make the US rich, he can make the citizens of the US rich by doing all of these things, you know. And like you see that in his, going back to the war, you know, he had this, he's trying to get businesses to stay in the US, and he praises one business for staying, and then he basically calls one out and then outlines his aggressive anti-business import policy all within the same Twitter stream. You know, I can't remember, they make bearings for engines or something, and they're moving to Mexico, and he basically calls out the CEO of the company and says, that's naughty, don't do that, and this is how I'm going to punish you. And if you're an outside business, that's really scary, but if you're, which means that you have to stay in the US, and if you stay in the US, you have to, it means that you generate jobs, and although it doesn't make everybody as rich as Donald Trump, it makes them feel better that there's this concept that there will be an economic boom with, if he's able to successfully translate his business practices into policies which get through or are enacted.
You end the book on Inauguration Day.
Mm-hmm.
You point out that whether by design or happenstance, he didn't live tweet the inauguration. For you, did this signal a change in rhetoric, a more presidential style, perhaps? And how do you see that moving forward?
At the time, yes, I thought that he'd won, so he'd stopped. He'd used the tool. It almost felt like his entire use of Twitter had just been to get him to this point, so he could stop, and then he could just get on with the next part. You know, he's done the he's essentially he's done the R&D and now he's gonna develop the product, and Twilio was the R&D. I was happy and sad. I was happy that he'd stopped in many ways, because he often says some fairly offensive stuff, and he says things which someone in his position should not be saying. I mean, a lot of the arguments I try to point out is that it's not that he's saying it, it's that he's saying it coming from the position of where he's at. You know, you can't antagonize China by using Taiwan when you are, you know, about to become the leader of one of the most powerful countries in the world. You know, you just can't do that. That's, you know, that's just crazy. So I was happy that he'd stopped, but I was also a little bit sad because from a book perspective, it would make a follow up book a bit tricky if he'd actually stopped using Twitter. But also, you know, he's quite entertaining. I mean, it's scary, but he makes a good read. When you're reading through his tweets, some of them are fun, you know, in terms of, I mean, they're not fun, but they make you laugh because the things he say are absurd. So I was concerned, happy but concerned that he'd stopped. Fortunately, it didn't last, and he was back on the ball pretty quick, and this is where the dynamic between at real Donald Trump and at POTUS 45 yes good at POTUS 45 where that comes into play, because, you know, because sometimes, you know, he says some things as POTUS and he says some things as Donald Trump, and then he gets POTUS to retweet the things that Trump has said, which is a way of him getting across what he truly means without him having to say it as the president of the United States tweeted this. The president just retweeted it, which means the president agrees with what this man is saying, but he can't say he can't illustrate it himself because of his position of power, which is an interesting idea considering they're both the same person. So it's sort of introduced this schizophrenia in the way that he is using social media to continue to drive his policies. I think it's safe to say that for it to be true that he is truly embraced social media in a way and is using it as a major tool for him to communicate his ideas, that he can't stop using Twitter, because otherwise it's just a very clever campaign strategy. I think he's always going to use Twitter because he, I guess it agrees with the way he wants to communicate. But the going forward, just comparing what he says on both accounts, in many ways it shows, you know, the ego of this man. That he can say this as one person, and then he feels that it's appropriate for the president's Twitter account to retweet the things that he's saying, even when they're things that, you know, that a man in that position in public office should probably be filtering out. But it's a trend. It's how he works. It's, if anything, we can say that at least he's consistent. And that's, he has consistency, and whether that's a good or a bad thing, I mean, consistency is usually a good thing. Whether it's a good thing in this case is, I guess we'll find out in, you know, 3.5 years time. But
James, we have taken up way too much of your time. Thank you very much. I would like to end on this note. You end your book with the following note to the reader. As Trump pursues the risque policies he campaigned for, as his advisors are appointed or resign, I am watching and taking note. There will be more books as Trump's political milestones become my editorial deadlines. How is Trump Tweets 2.0 shaping up?
Well, it's getting there. it's going to be interesting. We were hoping for a review of the end of the honeymoon period. But that hasn't quite happened. I think it's interesting to see that what Trump has become is he's now realized that is that the things that he promised are things that he can probably he's still going to try to do, but the job gets in the way. He still says some crazy things on social media. He still pushes through some bizarre policies. I think it's going to be different. It's not. It doesn't have the same aggression as the election book. But then that's not really what you want in a man of in that position. You don't want someone who's aggressive all the time. Whether he's, you know, it's going to be different. It's, you know, he's had to change the way he's done things, and that's reflected in the things he said. But at the end of the day, his core understanding of how to use social media hasn't changed. So he still says crazy things, but again, there's always this consistency in history. He's although his ideas may seem outrageous at the time, there's always a pattern that shows that he's always had those ideas. And that's what's interesting. That's what's going to make a year in review of what he's done interesting, is to see how that conflicts with him having to conform to conventional politics, which I think in many ways is why he wants to change it. It's because it doesn't work in the way that he needs it to work.
James, thank you so much for coming on here and being interviewed. I very much look forward to you returning for Trump Tweets, the second edition, which I
thank
think
you. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
The book is Trump Tweets, His Social Media Phenomenon. The author is James Poyner. I've been your host, Monica Wilkie, on the New Books Media and Communications channel. Thank you for listening, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.